We would like to send out a special thanks to ReadySlim for supporting The Trail Went Cold. ReadySlim focuses on providing the highest quality detox and keto products fit for any busy lifestyle. To save 25% on your first order of ReadySlim's 28-day detox tea kit for a limited time and get a free collapsible water bottle, go to readyslim.com/cold. And this episode is also sponsored by Over My Dead Body, a seasonal podcast from Wondery about people who are pushed beyond their limits and do unspeakable things. Follow Over My Dead Body on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now to hear Season 3, Fox Lake. Or you can listen early and ad-free by subscribing to Wondery Plus on the Wondery app. Thank you, and enjoy the show. February 14th, 1945. Lower Quinton, England. 74-year-old farm laborer Charles Walton leaves his home in order to slash hedges on the slopes of Meon Hill. Later that evening, Charles's body is discovered next to the hedgerow, and he has been beaten, had his throat slashed, and been stabbed with a pitchfork. While the original investigation turns up a potential suspect, there is not enough evidence to implicate him, but as the years go on, Charles's death becomes surrounded with urban legends involving witchcraft and the occult. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to this year's first Halloween-themed episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we're going to be traveling to the United Kingdom to cover a bizarre mystery, the 1945 murder of Charles Walton. As you probably know, it's a tradition for our podcast to spend the month of October covering mysteries with a spooky element as part of our countdown to Halloween, though ironically, this particular crime actually occurred on Valentine's Day. However, what's particularly strange about this case is that it started out as a standard murder investigation, but has since evolved into a story which is surrounded by urban legends. It involves a 74-year-old laborer named Charles Walton, who was murdered while working in a field near a small English village, as someone used a billhook to slash his throat and stabbed him with a pitchfork. Since Charles was a reclusive person who had no history of causing trouble and didn't have any known enemies, no one can understand why he would be killed in such a brutal fashion. The original investigator on this case, Robert Fabian, had his own ideas about who the perpetrator was, but as the years went on, rumors and urban legends started circulating that Charles's murder was somehow connected to witchcraft. In fact, this element has pretty much dominated most accounts of this story, and as a result, a lot of misinformation has spread, and it's become difficult to separate fact from fiction. For this reason, one of the primary sources for this episode is the 2014 book, The Case That Foiled Fabian, Murder and Witchcraft in Rural England, written by reporter Simon Reed, who managed to obtain the original police reports. It turns out that many of the more fantastical elements surrounding the case are likely not even true, so in this episode, we're not only going to explore the details of Charles Walton's murder, but also try to figure out why this story has wound up becoming so synonymous with witchcraft and the occult. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the murder of Charles Walton. Our story begins in 1945 in Quinton, a civil parish located in the Stratford-upon-Avon district of Warwickshire in England. The parish is divided into the villages of Lower Quinton and Upper Quinton, and has a population of 493 people. Our central figure is 74-year-old Charles Walton, who has lived in Lower Quinton his entire life. Charles is described as being something of a loner who mostly keeps to himself, and while he does not interact much with other villagers, he is known for being pleasant and friendly whenever he does. At this particular point in his life, Charles has been a widower for nearly 17 years following the death of his wife, and he lives in a rented cottage alongside his 33-year-old niece, Edith Walton. Charles and his wife adopted Edith when she was 3 years old after her own mother passed away, and she now functions as Charles's housekeeper. Charles is living as a pensioner, but he is able to obtain additional income by performing casual work as a farm laborer, though he suffers from rheumatism and sciatica, and is forced to use a pair of walking sticks to move around. Charles works as a part-time laborer for 40-year-old Alfred Potter, whose father owns a company named L.L. Potter & Sons, and Potter manages and lives at one of the company's farms, which is known as the Firs. On the morning of February the 14th, Charles left his cottage in order to spend the day working in a field known as Hill Ground, located on the slopes of Meon Hill, and witnesses would recall seeing him pass through a churchyard and heading in that direction sometime between 9 and 9:30 a.m. He was planning to trim a lengthy hedgerow in the field, and Charles left a pair of farm implements there, which he had borrowed from Potter. A pitchfork and a billhook, which is a double-edged pruning implement used to slash hedges. Edith Walton worked as a typesetter at the Royal Society of Arts, and after spending the day there, she went back to the cottage at 6 p.m. Edith was surprised to discover that Charles was not there, since it was his standard routine to return home at 4 o'clock. She became concerned enough to see a neighbor named Harry Beasley, and they both decided to go out searching for Charles. They went to the Firs to check if Charles might be there, and Alfred Potter told them that he had last seen Charles slashing hedges in Hill Ground shortly after noon. Potter agreed to accompany them to the field to search for Charles, but when they got to the end of the hedgerow, they were shocked to discover Charles's body on the ground. He had been the victim of a brutal murder, as the billhook had been used to slash his throat and trachea, and it was now embedded in his neck. The killer had also used the pitchfork to stab him and pin him to the ground, as the prongs were now sticking through each side of his face. Edith became hysterical over the sight of Charles's body, and when Potter saw another farm laborer passing by, he shouted at him to call the police. While Harry Beasley tried to comfort Edith and took her away from the scene, Potter stood guard over Charles's body until Constable Michael O'Masney of the Warwickshire County Constabulary arrived. Members of the Stratford-upon-Avon Criminal Investigation Division soon arrived at the scene, along with Professor James Webster, a pathologist from the West Midlands Forensic Laboratory. Webster would uncover a number of defensive wounds on Charles's hands and right forearm, and he had also been beaten on the head with one of his walking sticks, which was found near his body with traces of blood and hair on it. Charles's jacket and undercoat were also open, and his trousers were unfastened, as if someone had searched through his clothing for something. A chain which was ordinarily attached to a metal pocket watch Charles carried around was found inside his pocket, but the watch itself was missing. Even though details about the watch were later circulated to a number of jewelers and pawnbrokers in the area, it never turned up. A small purse Charles sometimes used to carry shillings around had been left behind at his cottage, so it did not seem like Charles had any money on him at the time of his death. Professor Webster estimated that Charles had died sometime between 1 and 2 p.m. on February the 14th, but I suppose now would be a good time to debunk one of the more sensationalistic elements of this murder. If you research this case online, you'll find numerous sources state that a cross had been carved into Charles's chest, but there is no mention of this cross in Webster's autopsy report or the original police reports, or any newspaper articles about this crime from this time period. We'll talk more about this later on, but it seems like the cross is just one of those details which was fabricated in order to add an extra aura of creepiness to the story, and got repeated so much over the years that it wound up being accepted as fact. Another sensationalized detail which has often been spread about the murder is that Charles's face was frozen with an expression of terror when his body was found, but once again, there's no mention of this in any of the official reports. The local authorities contacted Scotland Yard in London for assistance with the investigation, so Chief Inspector Robert Fabian and his partner, Detective Sergeant Albert Webb, made the trip to Lower Quinton. Now, to provide some backstory, Robert Fabian was one of the most famous police investigators in the United Kingdom at that time, and his celebrity would only increase following his retirement a few years later. Fabian wrote a number of popular books which detailed his police career, one of which, titled Fabian of the Yard, was adapted into a police procedural TV series during the mid-1950s. Fabian of the Yard was pretty much considered to be the British equivalent of the popular American TV show Dragnet, and each episode featured a fictionalized version of Fabian, portrayed by actor Bruce Seaton, solving a different case. At the end of the episode, Fabian himself would appear on camera to describe the real-life case he worked on, which had been the basis for the story. Some of the books Fabian wrote contained sections about the Charles Walton murder, and he definitely played a role in sensationalizing certain aspects of the case, but we'll talk more about that later. However, on the basis of his original police reports, it seems like Fabian treated the case as a standard homicide investigation and had his own ideas of who was responsible. At the outset, one of the most prominent theories involved Italian prisoners of war possibly being involved in Charles's murder, as World War II was still ongoing, and over 1,000 Italian POWs were being held at a camp in the village of Long Marston, located only about 2 miles away from the crime scene. The POWs were often allowed to freely roam through the area and could be seen in Lower Quinton during this time period, but they were not known for causing any trouble, and no evidence was ever found to link them with Charles's murder. Throughout the course of the investigation, Fabian and Webb took statements from around 500 local residents, but the only person whom Fabian considered to be a promising suspect was Charles's employer, Alfred Potter. When questioned by police, Potter claimed that he spent the morning of February the 14th working with another farmer named Joseph Stanley before they stopped by a local pub called the College Arms for a drink. They both left the pub at around noon and briefly returned to Stanley's farm before Potter started heading back to his own farm, the Firs. Potter walked to the lower slope of Meon Hill and was passing through a small field called Cax Lees, which was adjacent to hill ground. He said that he noticed Charles slashing the hedgerow about 500 to 600 yards in the distance, and at the time, it looked like he needed to slash about 6 to 10 yards worth of hedge before he finished the entire row. When Charles's body was discovered later that evening, it appeared that an additional 4 yards had been slashed, so if Potter's story was accurate, this suggested that Charles's death took place about a half hour after Potter last saw him. Potter said that he would have walked over to speak with Charles, but he had to deal with a dead heifer, which had drowned in a creek on his property the previous day, so he decided to head back to the farm and arrived at 12:40 p.m. Potter's wife Lillian confirmed that he returned home at this time, and one of Potter's farmhands, named Charles Henry Batchelor, told investigators that they soon started working together to pump some mangolds until around 1 o'clock. Potter had witnesses to corroborate his whereabouts throughout the majority of the afternoon until Edith Walton showed up to ask him to help search for Charles at around 6:15 p.m. However, throughout the course of the investigation, Potter did a number of things to make the authorities suspicious. For starters, when Constable O'Masney first arrived at the murder scene, he said Potter started complaining about how cold he was, which O'Masney found unusual, since Potter's job frequently required him to work outdoors in cold weather. Potter complained that he was hungry because he was interrupted before he had a chance to start his dinner, and for this reason, he decided to leave the scene and return home before the Stratford-upon-Avon CID arrived. O'Masney thought that Potter came across as very nervous and was looking for any reason to avoid speaking to investigators, who would not formally interview Potter until they paid him a visit at his farm hours later. At around 7 a.m. the following morning, Potter returned to the murder scene, which was now being guarded by another police constable named John West. Potter struck up a conversation with West and mentioned that he accidentally touched the handle of the pitchfork when he discovered Charles's body and left his fingerprints behind. However, Potter never made any mention of this when he was interviewed by other investigators the previous evening. In actuality, no legible fingerprints were found on the pitchfork or the billhook, but Potter would keep bringing up the subject during subsequent interviews. 6 days after the murder, Constable O'Masney showed up at the Firs to re-interview Potter, and when O'Masney brought up the possibility of checking the murder weapon for fingerprints, Potter mentioned that he may have touched the handle of the billhook, which caused his wife Lillian to start crying and become angry with him. In fact, there were multiple occurrences throughout the investigation when Mrs. Potter would become emotional while being interviewed and express her fear that the village was going to blame her husband for Charles's murder. Potter would later be interviewed by Fabian and Webb, where he once again shared the possibility that he could have accidentally left his fingerprints on one or both of the murder weapons. According to Potter, when he first discovered Charles's body, Harry Beasley said to him, quote, "You'd better have a look to make sure he is gone." When Potter touched Charles's body to check if he was dead, he may have inadvertently touched the handle of the billhook. However, when Fabian questioned Beasley about this, he denied ever saying those words and had no memory of seeing Potter touching the billhook that night. What also struck Fabian as odd is that at no point during any of his original interviews did Potter mention returning to the murder scene on the morning of February the 15th and speaking with Police Constable West about touching the pitchfork, as Fabian only learned about this after speaking with West himself. While he was being questioned, Fabian asked Potter to turn over the workman's clothes he had been wearing on the day Charles was killed for testing at the West Midland Forensic Science Laboratory. Potter agreed to do so, but also mentioned that they might find traces of blood on the knees of the breeches because he had birthed a calf a few days earlier. Indeed, when the tests were performed, Professor Webster reported that there were two areas which seemed to have presumptive traces of blood, but the breeches had been so well cleaned that it was impossible to tell if the blood was human. When Fabian later spoke to Mrs. Potter about this, she said she had no memory of her husband ever cleaning his work clothes. One of the oddest discrepancies involving Potter was when he recounted his story to Fabian for the first time about having seen Charles slashing the hedgerow in the distance on February the 14th, and specifically stated that Charles was working in his shirt sleeves. While Potter had never mentioned the detail about the shirt sleeves during his previous interviews, and it turned out that at the time he was killed, Charles had been wearing a jacket and undercoat, and a shirt with its sleeves cut off above the elbow. When confronted about this discrepancy, Potter acknowledged that he could no longer be certain that the person he saw was Charles, and perhaps this individual with the shirt sleeves was actually Charles's killer. Another detail which struck Fabian as odd was Potter's claim that he did not go over and speak with Charles because he needed to return to the Firs to attend to a dead heifer. However, when Potter first arrived, his wife claimed that he spent a few minutes reading the newspaper before he went to help his farmhand, Charles Henry Batchelor, pump some mangolds. Potter did not actually get around to removing the aforementioned heifer from the creek until 3 p.m. Since this was around 2.5 hours after Potter allegedly saw Charles in the Hillground field, why did he act like he needed to return home immediately? Each time he recounted this story, Potter also seemed to revise the exact time he claimed to have seen Charles, as it kept being pushed up to later in the day at such times as 12:10, 12:15, and 12:20 p.m. 1 month after the murder took place, Potter testified at a coroner's inquest which was being held at the town hall, and by this point, he stated that he had seen, quote-unquote, someone in the distance at Hillground at 12:30 p.m., but could not be certain it was Charles. Technically, there was no one who could account for Potter's whereabouts during a window of approximately 30 to 40 minutes from when he parted ways with Joseph Stanley to when he returned to his farm. During an interview with Fabian and Webb, Potter surprised them by admitting that he sometimes cooked the books by claiming wages from his father's company for work his employees never actually performed. For instance, Charles only worked for Potter part-time as his rheumatism prevented him from doing physical labor in cold weather. But Potter's book showed that Charles had been paid wages for every single week, so Potter was essentially pocketing the difference for himself. This led Fabian to speculate that perhaps Charles's murder was the result of some sort of financial dispute, but a check of Potter's background did not turn up any known history of violence, and in spite of the odd discrepancies in his story, there was no hard evidence to prove he had committed the crime. In the end, Fabian returned to London with the belief that Potter was the most likely suspect, but he was unable to make an arrest or close the case, and Potter died in 1974. It's been reported that when some workmen removed a row of outhouses behind Charles's former cottage in 1960, they wound up digging up a pocket watch which was buried in the ground. It was believed that this might have been the same pocket watch that went missing when Charles was murdered, but there is no official report that conclusively corroborates this. If you were to visit Lower Quinton today, you will not be able to find an official gravestone for Charles Walton, though rumor has it that one of his relatives had it destroyed after they became upset about the media visiting his gravesite on the anniversary of his murder every year. However, one article about the case published by the BBC featured a photograph of a small stone in the local churchyard, which has been marked with the initials CHW. So it's possible this is Charles's unofficial resting place. Over the past 76 years, a number of rumors, myths, and urban legends have circulated about the circumstances of Charles Walton's death, but the actual truth about what happened to him remains an unsolved mystery. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to send out a special thanks to ReadySlim, a wellness company that focuses on providing the highest quality detox and keto products for any busy lifestyle. When you're constantly working on a podcast, you're often going to need a good beverage to keep your energy levels up, but you also might need something to help you unwind once your work is done. I've mentioned before that I often like to drink tea while writing, researching, and recording my episodes, so that's why I like ReadySlim's detox teas, which are made with high-quality, 100% organic herbs, and have no fillers, no additives, and no laxatives. They're safe to drink daily, so they can gently boost your metabolism and help with digestion while also reducing bloating. ReadySlim's 28-day detox tea kit has everything you need, because you can either drink the wakey-wakey morning detox tea, which helps boost your energy levels to start your day off, or the snoozy night detox tea, which helps you relax and supports the natural detox process while you get your well-deserved beauty sleep. ReadySlim even helps aid in weight loss and is keto-friendly. Since I started drinking ReadySlim a few months ago, I've noticed that my metabolism has improved and my energy levels have boosted. I often like to alternate between the wakey-wakey and snoozy teas, depending on whether I want to bring my energy level up or unwind and sleep better, but they both work very effectively. So to save 25% on your first order of ReadySlim's 28-day detox tea kit for a limited time, go to readyslim.com/cold. You'll also get a free collapsible water bottle. That's readyslim.com/cold to save 25% on your first purchase of ReadySlim's 28-day detox tea kit plus a free collapsible water bottle. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. I'd also like to take a few moments to talk about Over My Dead Body, a seasonal podcast from Wondery about people who are pushed beyond their limits and do unspeakable things. After two exceptional seasons, this true crime show is back for a third season in order to share a story about corruption, betrayal, and the secrets of a fallen hero. It involves Joe Glinowitz, a hometown hero and 30-year veteran of the local police department in the small town of Fox Lake, Illinois. On September the 1st, 2015, when Glinowitz was just 1 month away from retirement, he was found dead outside an abandoned cement plant after having been shot twice in the chest. While the town and Joe's family mourned his passing, hundreds of police officers launched a manhunt to find his killer, but after weeks of searching, the lead investigators discovered chilling secrets about Joe, the local police department, and the village of Fox Lake. These secrets put the town in the national spotlight and haunted them for years to come. Now, if Joe Glinowitz's name sounds familiar, you might recall me briefly mentioning him earlier this year in episode number 209 of The Trail Went Cold, which covered the stories of Ralph Probst and Michael O'Mara, two other Illinois police officers who died under strange circumstances. But obviously, my summary of Glinowitz's case barely scratched the surface of how shocking it really was, which is why you need to listen to Over My Dead Body Season 3 to get the full story. So follow Over My Dead Body on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now to hear Season 3 Fox Lake. Or you can listen early and ad-free by subscribing to Wondery Plus in the Wondery app. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of this episode. So this is probably the first unsolved case I've ever covered on The Trail Went Cold, which is alleged to have ties with witchcraft. Of course, up until this point, I've only gone over the cold hard facts of the crime, but I'll be discussing how the witchcraft supposedly fits in momentarily. Like I mentioned in the intro, the Simon Reed published book, The Case That Foiled Fabian, Murder and Witchcraft in Rural England, has pretty much been a godsend for researching the story, since it was based on information from the original police and autopsy reports. If you wanted to put together a podcast episode about Charles Walton's murder prior to 2014, when this book was published, you would have had a very difficult time finding much in the way of credible sources and separating fantasy from reality. The fact of the matter is that Quinton is a very interesting place, which has always had urban legends surrounding it long before this crime took place. Charles was killed on the slopes of Meon Hill, a location which was once described as being the earthly domain of the devil. One particularly prominent local legend is that sometime during the 8th century, the devil kicked a massive boulder down Meon Hill in order to destroy the recently constructed Evesham Abbey. However, the villagers were able to stop the boulder through the power of prayer and then turned it into a giant cross to keep the devil away. So when a man is brutally murdered on this very same hill by being beaten with his walking stick, stabbed with a pitchfork, and having his throat slashed with a billhook, and the police are unable to solve this crime, I suppose it's inevitable that rumors would circulate about something supernatural having occurred. I mean, even if you take away all the false details which have been exaggerated over the years, such as the aforementioned cross being carved into Charles's chest, it's pretty inexplicable that someone would do this to a seemingly harmless 74-year-old man who could barely defend himself. Barring a logical motive, I can see why people would start attributing this crime to something like witchcraft. Now, I've already gone over the original investigation from Chief Inspector Robert Fabian, who became something of a celebrity in the United Kingdom during this time period. If you want to make a modern comparison to Fabian, think of someone like Paul Holes, who achieved extra fame after they retired from law enforcement by publishing books about their career and doing TV shows. Well, Fabian published more than one book following his retirement, which mentioned the Charles Walton murder, and even though there's nothing to indicate an angle involving witchcraft in his original police reports, he does mention the topic in his books. It's unclear if Fabian legitimately believed in witchcraft, or if he just exaggerated and sensationalized certain aspects of the story in order to help increase sales for his books. Well, maybe Fabian was just frustrated about being unable to find evidence to implicate his best original suspect, Alfred Potter, so he decided to treat the crime as some sort of supernatural event that a mere mortal like himself could not solve. In 1970, Fabian wrote in one of his memoirs, quote, "I advise anybody who is tempted at any time to venture into black magic, witchcraft, shamanism, call it what you will, to remember Charles Walton and to think of his death, which was clearly the ghastly climax of a pagan rite. There is no stronger argument for keeping as far away as possible from the villains with their swords, incense, and mumbo-jumbo. It is prudence on which your future peace of mind and even your life could depend." End quote. Regardless of whether or not Fabian believed all this, he certainly played a role in ensuring that all the urban legends involving witchcraft would continue to spread and muddy the waters of the case. But here's how the idea might have originally entered his head. After Fabian returned to London, the person who continued on the investigation into the murder was Detective Superintendent Alex Spooner, head of the Warwickshire County Constabulary, and he spent years attempting to crack the case without success. It's been reported that Spooner introduced Fabian to a couple of books about witchcraft and black magic in the area, and it's possible this could have influenced Fabian's views. One of these books, written by Clive Holland, entitled Warwickshire, the Land of Shakespeare, contained a story about a young boy who had spent the day working in the fields near Meon Hill in 1885, but as he was walking home, he came across what he described as a quote-unquote phantom black dog. Over the next few nights, the boy apparently kept seeing this black dog whenever he walked home, but the final time he saw it, the dog was accompanied by the spirit of a headless woman who quickly disappeared. The following day, this boy's sister suddenly died. Well, guess what this boy's name was? Charles Walton. For years, one of the most prominent theories is that the boy grew up to be the same Charles Walton from this case, but this terrifying experience caused him to become a reclusive old man. Not only that, but it turned Charles into a clairvoyant who had a unique ability to communicate with animals. As someone who was a lifelong resident of Lower Quinton, Charles would have been 15 years old and living in the area in 1885, but regardless of whether or not this story is actually true, the details do not match the facts from Charles' own life. According to British census records, Charles had three older sisters who were all shown to still be alive long after 1885, so even if Charles did have an encounter with a phantom black dog and saw a headless woman, the detail about his sister dying the very next day does not fit the timeline. One prominent local legend which has spread throughout the area for centuries is that these phantom hounds once belonged to an ancient Celtic king and would roam the slopes of Meon Hill at night to serve as guardians of the underworld. And believe it or not, in the years following Charles's murder, Fabian would describe his own eerie encounter with a dog during the original investigation. Fabian claimed that he was walking along the slopes of Meon Hill at dusk one night when he noticed a black dog appear on a stone wall before it leaped off and ran away. Shortly thereafter, Fabian crossed paths with a small boy and asked him if he was looking for his black dog, but this caused the boy to turn pale and run off. Fabian said that once word about his encounter with the dog spread throughout the village, the entire atmosphere seemed to change, and the residents were a lot less willing to talk to him. If you research this case, you'll find some sources state that a black dog was found hanging from a tree close to the murder scene during this time period, but once again, this detail is not mentioned in any of the official reports or contemporary newspaper accounts. I guess it's possible that Fabian did legitimately see a black dog at Meon Hill during his time there, but greatly exaggerated certain details as the years went on. Okay, so these stories about phantom dogs are odd enough, but how exactly did Charles Walton's murder get tied to witchcraft? Well, it seems like one of the first media outlets to mention this was a 9-year anniversary article about the crime published in the British tabloid The Daily Mirror in February of 1954. The article compared Charles's case to the murder of an 80-year-old woman named Anne Tennant, which took place on September the 15th, 1875, in the village of Long Compton, located about 15 miles from Lower Quinton. That evening, Anne was returning home after buying a loaf of bread when she was suddenly attacked by a farm worker named James Haywood, who stabbed her with a pitchfork. Another farmer intervened to stop the attack, and even though Anne was taken to her daughter's house to treat her injuries, she died about 3 hours later. Following his arrest, Haywood would claim that he killed Anne because she was a witch who had cursed him, and there were other witches in the village who needed to be killed as well. Haywood later went on trial for the crime, and I've read differing accounts of him either being found guilty of manslaughter and sent to prison, or being found not guilty by reason of insanity and sent to an asylum. It appears that details about this story have also been exaggerated to provide a closer parallel to Charles Walton's murder, as some accounts state that she had a cross carved into her body with a billhook, but this is not true at all, as there were multiple witnesses to the crime who confirmed that the only weapon Haywood used was a pitchfork. Other than the pitchfork, there really don't seem to be any connection between these two crimes, but the aforementioned Daily Mirror article contained this cryptic line, quote, "The police have found one other link between the killings, but I am not pledged to reveal it," end quote. Well, it's been speculated that Charles Walton and Anne Tennant were distant relatives, and that Anne possibly could have even been Charles's great-grandmother, but this was never positively confirmed. But the main reason these cases have been linked is due to a theory that Charles was also murdered over the belief that he himself was a witch. Yes, you will find sources, which allege that there were rumors throughout the area that Charles was a witch with magical powers who would take midnight trips to Meon Hill in order to participate in rituals. And remember how I mentioned these other rumors about Charles supposedly being a clairvoyant who could communicate with animals? Well, one of the more fantastical theories is that Charles liked to breed natterjack toads and keep them as pets before he set them loose to ruin the crops and livestock of the local farmers. The story goes that the area's harvest had been a failure in 1944 and was not looking much better for the spring of 1945, possibly because of Charles's witchcraft. You might recall that Alfred Potter had a heifer who drowned on February the 13th, the day before Charles was killed. This incident could have been the breaking point, which caused someone to murder Charles in a ritualistic manner, and the reason his throat was slashed and he was pinned to the ground with a pitchfork was so that his blood could soak into the ground and replenish the soil's fertility. I guess it's a situation which is kind of reminiscent of the classic 1973 horror film The Wicker Man, where residents of a remote Scottish island perform a human sacrifice in response to a poor harvest. Unfortunately, I think Robert Fabian kind of perpetuated this ridiculous theory when he wrote this passage in his book, Fabian in the Art, quote, One of my most memorable murder cases was at the village of Lower Quinton, near the stone druid circle of the Whispering Knights. There a man had been killed by a reproduction of a druidical ceremony on St. Valentine's Eve, end quote. While putting aside the fact that Charles was killed on Valentine's Day, not Valentine's Eve, these stones Fabian was referring to, called the Whispering Knights, are actually located 12 miles away from the murder scene and have nothing to do with druids. I mean, when the lead investigator on the case is writing stuff like this in his book and contradicting his very own police reports, you can understand why so much misinformation has spread over the years. There definitely seemed to be some sort of hysteria about witchcraft during the 1950s, because while I was researching this episode, I actually found mention of this case in an article published in the June 21st, 1956 edition of the Arizona Republic under the headline, quote, "Revival of Witchcraft Orgies Alarms Britain." I also think some of the lore surrounding this case might also be due to another unsolved murder which took place less than 2 years earlier in the village of Hagley, located just over 40 miles away. On April the 18th, 1943, a group of boys discovered a woman's skeletal remains stuffed inside a wick elm tree, but the victim could not be identified, and the story would gain additional notoriety the following year when the cryptic graffiti, "Who put Wellett down the wick elm, Hagley Wood," suddenly appeared on a wall. An anthropologist slash archaeologist named Margaret Murray would eventually push forward the theory that the woman's death was connected to witchcraft and she was killed in some sort of occult ritual, and it wasn't long before a number of parallels were made with Charles Walton's murder. Of course, I don't want to talk too much about the Wick Elm murder right now, since I might wind up covering it on a future episode of the podcast. All that being said, as skeptical as I might sound about this whole situation, it is a proven fact that James Haywood murdered Anne Tennant because he legitimately believed she was a witch. Even though there's no indication that all these ridiculous rumors about Charles existed prior to his death, could there have been at least one mentally unstable villager who got it into their head that Charles was a witch and decided to murder him for it? Well, the thing with Haywood is that he committed his murder in full view of witnesses and was so swept up in his own delusions that he didn't seem to care if he was caught. But whoever murdered Charles did so covertly in an isolated setting. You would think that if someone thought they were serving the greater good by killing a witch, they would have opened their mouth and said something over the years. I know that in his books, Fabian often made reference to a quote-unquote wall of silence he faced during his investigation, and he once wrote, quote, "The natives of Upper and Lower Quinton and the surrounding district are of a secretive disposition, and they do not take easily to strangers," end quote. However, Fabian's original police report seemed to contradict this, as it sounds like most of the villagers he spoke to were very cooperative, and if they didn't provide him with any useful information, that might simply be because they didn't know anything. I think Fabian was just taken by surprise, because the village had a population of less than 500 people at that time, and since it's very difficult for a community that small to keep a secret, he figured that someone would eventually talk. However, we are talking about a crime which took place in a remote field without any witnesses around, so it's possible that the only person who knew anything about what happened was the killer. So once we discount the possibility of witchcraft, the occult, druids, and phantom dogs being connected to Charles's murder, what are we left with? Well, even though being stabbed with a pitchfork, beaten with a walking stick, and having your throat slashed with a billhook is a brutal way to go, it's important to remember that Charles had all those items with him when he trimmed the hedgerow that day. If his death was premeditated murder, it seems more logical that the perpetrator would have brought their own weapon with them, but the fact that Charles was attacked with weapons which were already at the scene suggests this was an impulsive act. The killer may not have initially planned on murdering Charles when they first approached him, until something happened which escalated things into violence. It's definitely major overkill to use all those weapons on an arthritic 74-year-old man. As far as I can tell, all the witchcraft rumors surrounding Charles did not pop up until years after the crime, so even though he was a reclusive man who did not spend a lot of time socializing with others, he was also not known for causing any trouble or making enemies, so no one actually seemed to dislike him. I mean, his niece Edith lived in the same cottage and helped take care of him, so you'd think that if there was something strange going on in Charles's life, where he had a darker side, she would have noticed and said something. I know that during the early stages of the investigation, The Italian POWs being housed nearby seemed like a convenient scapegoat, but it sounds like Fabian pursued that angle thoroughly and found nothing to indicate that any of them were involved. But it is interesting that one of the most vocal people behind the POW theory was Alfred Potter, who openly expressed his belief that Charles was murdered by an Italian fascist during more than one police interview. So overall, there really aren't any compelling suspects in this crime besides Potter, but in spite of the troubling discrepancies in his story, there are still a lot of unanswered questions about him. It didn't seem Potter was particularly well-liked by some people, and interestingly enough, two of the farmhands who worked for him at the Furs wound up quitting in the weeks following Charles's murder. One of them was Charles Henry Batchelor, who technically functioned as an alibi witness for Potter on the afternoon of the crime. He claimed that he quit because Potter refused to give him a raise, so he found another job elsewhere, but you have to wonder if the cloud of suspicion about Potter being a potential murderer may have influenced Batchelor's decision. We also know that Potter could be dishonest, as he flat out admitted that he would sometimes shortchange his workers on their wages and cook the books in order to pocket money for himself, even though his very own father owned the company. But Potter also did not have any known history of violence, so the potential motive for what could have possessed him to murder Charles in such a brutal fashion is still a puzzling mystery. So to recap, Charles left his cottage in order to spend the day trimming the hedgerow and hill ground field on the slopes of Meon Hill, but the last confirmed sighting of him from anyone else besides Potter was an eyewitness who saw Charles heading in that direction at around 9:30 a.m. We know that Potter spent the morning with another farmer named Joseph Stanley, so his whereabouts are accounted for until sometime between noon and 12:10 p.m., and Potter's wife and Batchelor both confirmed that he arrived back at his farm at around 12:40. Since Potter spent this 30 to 40 minute window walking alone, he technically has no verified alibi for that time period, though he claimed he saw Charles trimming the hedges in the distance while passing by Hillground. However, Potter kept revising the exact time he saw Charles, and it seems like the more suspicious the investigators got, the further he would push the time forward. At one point, he said the sighting occurred as late as 12:30, which would obviously make it very difficult for him to kill Charles and arrive at the Furs only 10 minutes later, but we can't even be certain if this time is accurate. While Potter certainly would have had enough time to commit the crime, I guess there's some question about whether there was ample time to clean up any blood or physical evidence he might have gotten on himself. There were presumptive traces of blood on the knees of the breeches Potter wore that day, which he claimed had been the result of birthing a calf, which could very well be true. But what struck Fabian as odd was just how clean the breeches were, as even Mrs. Potter said it was very out of character for her husband to thoroughly wash his work clothes. As you recall, when Charles's body was found, his jacket and undercoat were open, and his trousers were unfastened. Fabian's theory was that if Potter was the killer, he may have kneeled down to search through Charles's clothing and accidentally got blood on the knees of his breeches, which is why he felt the need to clean them so thoroughly. The thing with Potter is that the odd inconsistencies in his constantly changing story might not seem that damning on their own, but when you combine them all together, they create some major red flags. One of the strangest is when Potter suddenly decided to add in the detail that he saw Charles working in his shirt sleeves, even though Charles was wearing a jacket and a sleeveless shirt that day. Of course, since he was over 500 yards away, it's possible that Potter may have been mistaken and actually saw another person, possibly even Charles's killer. However, the problem is that Potter also said Charles had at least 6 to 10 yards left to slash on the hedgerow, but by the time Charles's body was found, it appeared that an additional 4 yards were slashed. This means that if Potter was telling the truth, then Charles would have needed to continue slashing the heads for another half hour or so before he was murdered. And, well, if the person Potter saw was the killer, it seems very unlikely they would continue Charles's work for him. So it's possible Potter intentionally fabricated that detail in order to plant the false seed that he saw the real perpetrator, thereby directing suspicion away from himself. It's also odd how Potter claimed he never attempted to walk over and speak to Charles because he needed to get back to his farm to tend to a deceased heifer in a nearby creek, yet it sounds like the very first thing he did when he arrived was lounge around and read the newspaper for a few minutes, and he didn't even get around to removing the heifer until over 2 hours later. Another red flag with Potter was his constant need to tell people he may have accidentally touched the murder weapons, as if he was preemptively trying to provide an explanation if his fingerprint showed up on them. I mean, if he legitimately believed he touched them, then it's understandable that he would say something, but the pitchfork and the billhook technically belonged to Potter anyway, since Charles had borrowed both of them to perform his work. That could have provided another innocent explanation to account for Potter's fingerprints being on there, yet he seemed to go out of his way to constantly mention touching the handles. The first time he brought up this possibility was when he spoke to Police Constable Webb at the murder scene on the morning after the crime, yet he never even mentioned paying this impromptu visit to the murder scene during his subsequent interviews with investigators. And Potter provided a story about potentially leaving his fingerprints on the billhook after Harry Beasley told him to check Charles's body to make sure he was dead, but Beasley always denied ever saying this to him. Chief Inspector Fabian also found it interesting that whenever he interviewed Lillian Potter, she was always so certain of pinning down the exact time she saw her husband arrive home and go out to do work, yet she couldn't remember a number of other specific details from that day, such as what they ate for lunch. Fabian got the impression that Potter may have coached his wife and told her what specific times to say she saw him whenever she spoke with the police. Mrs. Potter also frequently got emotional and started crying during these interviews and attributed that to her fear that her husband would get unjustly blamed for the crime. But you have to wonder if she knew more about the murder than she was letting on and was racked with guilt about the whole situation. However, even though there are a number of strange inconsistencies in Potter's story, they still do not provide conclusive evidence that he's guilty of murder, and of course, there's still the unanswered question of motive. I already discussed how Potter had a tendency to cook the books by claiming more wages than he paid to his workers and pocketing the difference for himself. There were apparently a few incidents in the past where Potter failed to pay Charles his wages on time, and other laborers in the village who had previously worked with Potter also alleged they had issues with getting him to pay what he owed. So if this was an ongoing problem, perhaps that led to a heated confrontation between Charles and Potter, which escalated into violence. Even though Charles wasn't carrying any money at the time, someone did steal his pocket watch, and it appears that they searched through his entire clothing. I know it's been reported that the watch was found buried behind Charles's cottage 15 years later, which would be a complete head-scratcher, but we can't be 100% certain if this is true. But one detail which always intrigued Fabian is that Edith Walton and some of the other villagers seemed to be under the impression that Charles had more money than he did, as he lived frugally and collected a decent amount of wages working for various employers over the years. Yet when Charles's bank account was checked, there really wasn't much money in there at all, as his savings had dwindled from £227 in 1929 to just over £2 at the time of his death. So what did he spend this money on? This led to speculation that Charles may have had some additional funds stashed somewhere, and one theory which has been pushed around over the years is that Potter was experiencing financial problems and convinced Charles to loan him some money, which is why it was withdrawn from his account. If Charles was carrying this money on him when he went out into the fields to trim the hedgerow, or someone believed he was carrying a lot of money, perhaps the motive for this crime was robbery. The killer could have either taken the money or was disappointed to discover that Charles didn't have any money after searching his clothing. But again, using a pitchfork, billhook, and a walking stick to kill an elderly man while robbing him just seems like major overkill. I don't think Charles would have been capable of putting up much resistance if someone tried to steal from him, but if he recognized his attacker, that person might have felt murder was the only option. Another possibility is that if Charles loaned Potter money, he could have confronted Potter about paying him back and wound up being killed for it, but it's never been substantiated that any loan ever took place. Overall, I would say that Alfred Potter being the killer is the theory which makes the most sense, but there are just too many unexplained details to believe that with 100% certainty. So this only opens up the question, if Potter did not do this, then who did? I mean, for all we know, it could have just been some random person who was passing through the village, saw an old man working in the field alone, and for whatever reason, decided to take advantage of the situation by brutally murdering him and managed to get away without being seen. If the killer was not a local resident and immediately left Lower Quinton, then that would have made them a lot harder to catch. Interestingly enough, in August of 1948, Detective Inspector Alex Spooner learned about a man named Ernest Roy Smith, who was awaiting trial in Lincolnshire on a burglary charge, and Spooner became intrigued once he learned that Smith was from Upper Quinton. Spooner even sent the details about Charles's missing pocket watch to the Lincolnshire County Police, but never found any evidence to suggest he was involved in the crime, and this lead had another dead end. I know it's been stated that it's very difficult for all the residents of a small community to keep such a large secret all these years, but maybe there is no secret to keep, because the only people who know the truth about what happened are Charles and his killer. After all this time, the perpetrator is likely long dead, and they may have gotten incredibly lucky that so much focus and attention eventually turned to the witchcraft angle, which would dominate the case for the next several decades. Until Simon Reed's book was published in 2014, I'd wager that most people who were familiar with this story never even knew about Alfred Potter's role in this case as a potential suspect, and that Charles's death was initially treated as a standard homicide investigation. But even if you disregard all the supernatural elements, this was still a pretty baffling and uncommonly brutal crime, which managed to stump one of the most renowned police inspectors of that time period. I guess the silver lining of such misinformation being spread about the case over the years is that it helped keep it alive, so at the very least, Charles Walton will not be forgotten. If by chance, after all these years, you happen to have any information about this crime, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Last month, we released a sequel to a popular Patreon episode we did a few years ago titled The Trail Went Hot, and this time, I go over a number of cases which were featured in articles I wrote for listverse.com over the years and have since wound up being solved. As a token of appreciation for recently cracking the milestone of 500 Patreon supporters, we are making this particular episode available to all of our patrons in tiers 1, 2, and 3. I'm also going to be dropping the occasional exclusive bonus Patreon episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, and we recently released an episode in which myself and my co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discussed the unsolved abduction of Angela Hammond. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be placed over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'm also pleased to announce that The Trail Went Cold has been added to the lineup for Podcast Row at CrimeCon 2022, which is being held in Las Vegas from April the 29th until May the 1st. If you would like to purchase tickets, we already have our own personalized promo code to get a discount. So to receive a 10% discount off a standard badge, please visit crimecon.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. Once again, that's crimecon.com and the promo code is TRAIL. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after-show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's getvocal.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for our next Halloween-themed episode of The Trail Went Cold.